We've had a go for auto sequence start. The SRB hydraulic power units have started. T-minus 21 seconds, and the solid rocket booster engine gimbal now underway. T-minus 15 seconds.
T-minus 10,
9, 8, 7, 6. We have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1, and liftoff. Liftoff, and it has cleared the tower.
Surgeon Radio Network calling. Insurgent Radio Network calling. This is Insurgent Radio Network calling.
The station with the happy difference.
And this is Tom Metzger, Terrible Tommy, in the heartland and in the bunker, ready for another big shoe here today, right here on off stage. Yeah.
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581 is the address. Address your mail to either Box Holder or Tom Metzger or the Insurgent, and we'll get it, no matter which one you use. Yeah.
Yeah, there we go. White Air and Resistance Radio here again, right here from the bunker. Get my microphone set up here. Yeah, and it's a beautiful day here in the Midwest. It's up in the 80s, and but that damn grass is growing too fast, way too fast. And that is show business. That's show business, and this is the 23rd, right? 23rd? Let me look on the Frank Silva Memorial Clock here. 23rd, yeah, May the 23rd, 2015, and we're off and running. Get your donations for the radio show in here and any other donations, and we'll see that it gets put in the right place. And so let's see what we're going to do today. Well, we've got the webmaster on here. The webmaster is going to do another section of the book, reading of the book Antebellum, but the sub book is... yeah, got the wrong spot in here. But anyhow, it's the book about the South and what was really going on and how it affected the white working class. Yeah, they never isolate that. They talk about the white South. Well, there were two white Souths. There was a small number of aristocratic super rich, and there was the super poor white people. And then the Negroes were in between on the plantations working for board and room and food. And they buried them when they died, cradle to grave. They had perfect socialism on the plantation. But the whites didn't have it that way. And you'll begin to notice that as you listen to this reading of this book. And that there should have never been a black person brought into North America. Especially to as slaves, and when they were released as slaves, they should have been returned to the motherland, to where they could continue with their evolutionary track, which is probably about, as I think Carlton Kuhn said, about 250,000 years behind the Aryan or white race. But there's a lot of people think that they know more than Mother Nature. They're smarter than Mother Nature, and they're going to take somebody that's... not fully evolved or and bring him up to speed in another, 100 years? Well, it's not possible. It's just not possible. And we're finding that out now as the country sinks into stupid is as stupid does on every level. Every level. So let's get there to the show here and do it again. Continuing with that great book, Hinton, by Hinton Rowan Helper, title, Impending Crisis of the South and How to Meet It. If they'd have listened to him, they'd have been all right, but they didn't listen to him because only the super rich and the predatory capitalist plantation owners ran the show. And they're bound to drag the South into a crazy war.
So hyperbolically has the importance of cotton been magnified by certain pro-slavery politicians of the South that the person who would give credence to all their fuchsin and bombast would be under the necessity of believing that the very existence of almost everything in the heaven above, in the earth beneath, and in the water under the earth depended on it. The truth is, however, that the cotton crop is of but little value to the South. New England and Old England, by their superior enterprise and sagacity, turn it chiefly to their own advantage. It is carried in their ships, spun in their factories, woven in their looms, insured in their offices, returned again in their own vessels, and with double freight and cost of manufacturing added, purchased by the South at a high premium. Of all the parties engaged or interested in its transportation and manufacture, the South is the only one that does make a profit, nor does she as a general thing make a profit by producing it. We are credibly informed that many of the farmers in the immediate vicinity of Baltimore, where we now write, have turned their attention exclusively to hay, and that from 1 acre they frequently gather 2 tons, for which they receive $50. Let us now inquire how many dollars may be expected from an acre planted in cotton. Mr. Cameron, from whose able address before the Agricultural Society of Orange County, North Carolina, we have already gleaned some interesting particulars, and who informs us that the cotton planters in his part of the country, quote, have contented themselves with a crop yielding only $10 or $12 per acre, and that, quote, the summing up of a large surface gives but a living result, end quote. An intelligent resident of the Palmetto State, writing in DeBow's Review not long since, advances the opinion that the cotton planters of South Carolina are not realizing more than 1% on the amount of capital they have invested. While in Virginia, very recently an elderly slaveholder, whose religious walk and conversation had recommended and promoted him to an eldership in the Presbyterian Church, and who supports himself and family by raising niggers and tobacco, told us that for the last 8 or 10 years, aside from the increase of his human chattels, he felt quite confident he had not cleared as much as even 1% per annum on the amount of his investment. The real and personal property of this aged Christian consists chiefly in a large tract of land and about 30 Negroes, most of whom, according to his own confession, are more expensive than profitable. The proceeds arising from the sale of tobacco they produce in the purchase of meat and bread for home consumption, and when the crop is stunted by drought, frost, or otherwise cut short, one of the Negroes must be sold to raise funds for the support of the others. Such are the agricultural achievements of slave labor. Such are the results of, quote, the sum of all villainies, end quote. The diabolical institution subsists on its own flesh. At one time, children are sold to procure food for the parents. At another, parents are sold to procure food for the children. Within its pestilential atmosphere, nothing succeeds. Progress and prosperity are unknown. Inanition and slothfulness ensue. Everything becomes dull, dismal, and unprofitable. Wretchedness and desolation run riot through the land. An aspect of most melancholy inactivity and dilapidation broods over every city and town. Ignorance and prejudice sit enthroned over the minds of the people. Usurping despots wield the scepter of power everywhere, in everything, between Delaware Bay and the Gulf of Mexico, are the multitudinous evils of slavery apparent. The soil itself soon sickens and dies beneath the unnatural tread of the slave. Hear what the Honorable C.C. Clay of Alabama has to say upon the subject. His testimony is eminently suggestive, well-timed, and truthful, and we heartily commend it to the careful consideration of every spirited Southern who loves his country and desires to see it rescued from the fatal grasp of the, quote, mother of harlots, end quote. Says he, quote, I can show you with sorrow in the older portions of Alabama and in my native county of Madison the sad memorials of the artless and exhausting culture of cotton. Our small planters, after taking the cream off their lands, unable to restore them by rest, manure, or otherwise, are going further west and south in search of other virgin lands. Our wealthier planters, with greater means and no more skill, are buying out their poorer neighbors, extending their plantations, and adding to their slave force. The wealthy few who are able to live on smaller profits and give their blasted fields some rest are thus pushing off the many who are merely independent. Of the $20 million annually realized from the sales of the cotton crop of Alabama, nearly all not expended in supporting producers, is reinvested in land and Negroes. Thus, the white population has decreased, and the slave increased almost pari passu in several counties of our state. In 1825, Madison County cast about 3,000 votes. Now she cannot cast exceeding 2,300. In traversing that county, one will discover numerous farmhouses, once the abode of industrious and intelligent freemen, now occupied by slaves, or tenantless, deserted and dilapidated. He will observe fields, once fertile, now unfenced, abandoned, and covered with those evil harbingers, foxtail and broom's edge. He will see the moss growing on the moldering walls of once thrifty villages, and will find, quote, "one only master grasps the whole domain," end quote, that once furnished happy homes for a dozen white families. Indeed, a country in its infancy, where 50 years ago scarce a forest tree had been felled by the axe of a pioneer, is already exhibiting the painful signs of senility and decay, apparent in Virginia and the Carolinas. Someone has said that, quote, "an honest confession is good for the soul," end quote. And if the adage be true, as we have no doubt it is, we think Mr. C.C. Clay is entitled to a quiet conscience on one score at least. In the extract quoted above, he gives us a graphic description of the ruinous operations and influences of slavery in the Southwest. And we, as a native of Carolina and a traveler through Virginia, are ready to bear testimony to the fitness of his remarks when he referred to those states as examples of senility and decay. With equal propriety, however, he might have stopped nearer home for a subject of comparison. Either of the states bordering upon Alabama, or indeed any other slave state, would have answered his purpose quite as well as Virginia and the Carolinas. Wherever slavery exists, there he may find parallels to the destruction that is sweeping with such deadly influence over his own unfortunate state. As for examples of vigorous, industrious, and thrifty communities, they can be found anywhere beyond the upas shadow of slavery. Nor else. New York and Massachusetts, which by nature are confessedly far inferior to Virginia and the Carolinas, have, by the most liberal and equitable policy which they have pursued, in substituting liberty for slavery, attained a degree of eminence and prosperity altogether unknown in the slave states. Amidst all the hyperbole and cajolery of slave-driving politicians, who, as we have already seen, are, quote, "the books, the arts, the academies that show, contain, and govern all the South," end quote, we are rejoiced to see that Mr. Clay, Mr. Cameron, and a few others have had the boldness and honesty to step forward and proclaim the truth. All such frank admissions are to be hailed as good omens for the South. Nothing good can come from any attempt to conceal the unconcealable evidences of poverty and desolation everywhere trailing in the wake of slavery. Let the truth be told on all occasions, of the North as well as of the South, and the people will soon begin to discover the egregiousness of their errors, to draw just comparisons, to inquire into cause and effect, and to adopt the more utile measures, manners, and customs of their wiser contemporaries. In willfully traducing and decrying everything north of Mason-Dixon's line, and in excessively magnifying the importance of everything south of it, the oligarchy have, in the eyes of all liberal and intelligent men, only made an exhibition of their uncommon folly and dishonesty. For a long time, it is true, they have succeeded in deceiving the people, in keeping them humbled in the murky sloughs of poverty and ignorance, and instilling into their untutored minds passions and prejudices expressly calculated to strengthen and protect the accursed institution of slavery. But thanks to heaven, their inglorious reign is fast drawing to a close, with irresistible brilliancy, and in spite of the interdict of tyrants, light from the pure fountain of knowledge is now streaming over the dark places of our land, and ere long, mark our words, there will ascend from Delaware and from Texas and from all the intermediate states a huzza for freedom and for equal rights that will utterly confound the friends of despotism, set at defiance the authority of usurpers, and carry consternation to the heart of every slavery propagandist. To undeceive the people of the South, to bring them to a knowledge of the inferior and disreputable position which they occupy as a component part of the Union, and to give prominence and popularity to those plans which, if adopted, will elevate us to equality socially, morally, intellectually, industrially, politically, and financially with the most flourishing and refined nation in the world. And if possible, to place us in the van of even that is the object of this work. Slaveholders, either from ignorance or from a willful disposition to propagate error, contend that the South has nothing to be ashamed of, that slavery has proved a blessing to her, and that her superiority over the North in an agricultural point of view makes amends for all her shortcomings in other respects. On the other hand, we contend that many years of continual blushing and severe penance would not suffice to cancel or annul the shame and disgrace that justly attaches to the South in consequence of slavery, the direst evil that e'er befell the land, that the South bears nothing like even a respectable approximation to the North in navigation, commerce, or manufactures, and that contrary to the opinion entertained by 99 hundredths of her people, she is far behind the free states in the only thing of which she has ever dared to boast, agriculture. We submit the question to the arbitration of figures, which it is said do not lie, with regard to the bushel measure products of the soil, of which we have already taken an inventory. We have seen that there is a balance against the South in favor of the North of 17,423,152 bushels, and a difference in the value of the same, also in favor of the North, of $44,782,636. It is certainly a most novel kind of agricultural superiority that the South claims on that score. Our attention shall now be directed to the 12 principal pound measure products of the free and of the slave states: hay, cotton, butter and cheese, tobacco, cane, sugar, wool, rice, hemp, maple sugar, beeswax and honey, flax and hops. And in taking an account of them, we shall, in order to show the exact quantity produced in each state, and for the convenience of future reference, pursue the same plan as that adopting in the preceding tables. Whether slavery will appear to better advantage on the scales than it did in the half bushel remains to be seen. It is possible that the rickety monster may make a better show on a new track. If it makes a more ridiculous display, we shall not be surprised. A careful examination of its precedents has taught us the folly of expecting anything good to issue from it in any manner whatever. It has no disposition to emulate the magnanimity. A careful examination of its precedents has taught us the folly of expecting anything good to issue from it in any manner whatever. It has no disposition to emulate the magnanimity of its betters, and as for a laudable ambition to excel, that is a characteristic altogether foreign in its nature. Languor and inertia are the salutary viands upon which it delights to satiate its morbid appetite. And, quote, from bad to worse is the ill-omened motto under which, in all its feeble efforts and achievements, it acts out a most miserable and deleterious existence. No figures of rhetoric can add emphasis or significance to these figures of arithmetic above. They demonstrate conclusively the great moral triumph of liberty over slavery. They show unequivocally, in spite of all the blarney and boasting of slave-driving politicians, that the entire value of all the agricultural interests in the free states is very nearly twice as great as the entire value of all the agricultural interests of the slave states, the value of those interests in the former being 2,500 millions of dollars, that of those in the latter only 1,400 million, leaving a balance in favor of the free states of 1,188,299,803. That is what we call a full, fair, and complete vindication of free labor. Would we not be correct in calling it a total eclipse of the black orb? Can it be possible that the slaveocracy will ever have the hardihood to open their mouths again on the subject of terriculture in the South? Dare they ever think of cotton again? Ought they not, as a befitting confession of their crimes and misdemeanors, and as a reasonable expiation for the countless evils which they have inflicted on society, to clothe themselves in sackcloth, and after a suitable season of contrition and severe penance, follow the example of one Judas Iscariot and go and hang themselves? It will be observed that we have omitted the territories and the District of Columbia in all the preceding tables. We did this purposefully. Our object was to draw an equitable comparison between the value of free and slave labor in the 31 sovereign states, where the two systems, comparatively unaffected by the wrangling of politicians, and as a matter of course, free from the interference of the general government, have had the fullest opportunities to exert their influence, to exhibit their virtues, and to commend themselves to the sober judgments of enlightenment and discriminating minds. Had we counted the territories on the side of the North and the District of Columbia on the side of the South, the result would still have been greater in behalf of free labor. Though, quote, the sum of all villainies has but a mere nominal existence in Delaware and Maryland, we have invariably counted those states on the side of the South. And the consequence is that, in many particulars, the hopeless fortune of slavery have been propped up and sustained by an imposing array of figures which, of right, ought to be regarded as a property of freedom. But we like to be generous to an unfortunate foe, and would utterly disdain the use of any unfair means of attack or we shall take no undue advantage of slavery. It shall have a fair trial, and be judged according to its deserts. Already has it been weighed in the balance and found wanting. It has been measured in the half bushel and found wanting. It has been apprised in the field and found wanting. Whatever redeeming traits or qualities it may possess, if any, shall be brought to light by subjecting it to other tests. It was our desire and intention to furnish a correct table of the gallon measure products of the several states of the Union, but we have not been successful in our attempt to procure the necessary statistics. Enough is known, however, to satisfy. It was our desire and intention to furnish a correct table of the gallon measure products of the several states of the Union, but we have not been successful in our attempt to procure the necessary statistics. Enough is known, however, to satisfy us that the value of the milk, wine, ardent spirits, malt liquors, fluids, oils, and molasses annually produced and sold in the free states is at least 50 millions of dollars greater than the value of the same articles annually produced and sold in the slave states. Of sweet milk alone, it is estimated that the monthly sales in three northern cities, New York, Philadelphia, and Boston, amount to a larger sum than the marketable value of all the rosin, tar, pitch, and turpentine annually produced in the southern states. Our efforts to obtain reliable information respecting another very important branch of profitable industry, the lumber business, have also proved unavailing, and we are left to conjecture as to the amount of revenue annually derived from it in the two grand divisions of our country. The person whose curiosity prompts him to take an account of the immense piles of northern lumber now lying on the wharves and houseless lots in Baltimore, Richmond, and other slaveholding cities will not, we imagine, form a very flattering opinion of the products of southern forests. Let it be remembered that nearly all the clippers, steamers, and small craft are built at the north, and that large cargoes of eastern lumber are exported to foreign countries. That 9/10 of the wooden ware used in the southern states is manufactured in New England. That in outrageous disregard of the natural rights and claims of southern mechanics, the markets of the South are forever filled with northern furniture, vehicles, axe helves, walking canes, yardsticks, clothespins, and penholders. That the extraordinary number of factories, steam engines, forges, and machine shops in the free states require an extraordinary quantity of cordwood. That a large majority of the magnificent edifices and other structures, both private and public, in which timber, in its various forms, is extensively used, are to be found in the free states. We say, let all these things be remembered, and the truth will at once flash across the mind that the forests of the North are a source of far greater income than those of the South. The difference is simply this. At the North, everything is turned to advantage. When a tree is cut down, the main body is sold or used for lumber, railing or paling, the stump for matches and shoe pegs, the knees for shipbuilding, and the branches for fuel. At the south, everything is either neglected or mismanaged. Whole forests are felled by the ruthless hand of slavery. The trees are cut into logs, rolled into heaps, covered with the limbs and brush, and then burned on the identical soil that gave them birth. The land itself next falls a prey to the fell destroyer, and that which was once a beautiful, fertile, and luxuriant woodland is now despoiled of all its treasures and converted into an eye-offending desert. Were we to go beneath the soil and collect all the mineral and lapidarious wealth of the free states, we should find it so much greater than the corresponding wealth of the slave states that no ordinary combination of figures would suffice to express the difference. To say nothing of the gold and quicksilver of California, the iron and coal of Pennsylvania, the copper of Michigan, the lead of Illinois, or the salt of New York, the marble and freestone quarries of New England, are incredible as it may seem to those unacquainted with the facts, far more important sources of revenue than all the subterranean deposits in the slave states. From the most reliable statistics within our reach, we are led to the inference that the total value of all the precious metals, rocks, minerals, and medicinal waters annually extracted from the bowels of the free states is not less than $85 million. The whole value of the same substances annually brought up from beneath the surface of the slave states does not exceed $12 million. In this respect, to what is our poverty ascribable? To the same cause that has impoverished and dishonored us in all other respects. The thriftless and degrading institution of slavery. Nature has been kind to us in all things. The strata and substrata of the South are profusely enriched with gold and silver, and precious stones, and from the natural orifices and aqueducts in Virginia and North Carolina flow the purest healing waters in the world. But of what avail is all this latent wealth? Of what avail will it ever be, so long as slavery is permitted to play the dog in the manger? To these queries there can be but one reply. Slavery must be suppressed. The South, so great and so glorious by nature, must be reclaimed from her infamy and degradation. Our cities, fields, and forests must be kept intact from the unsparing monster. The various and ample resources of our vast domain, subterraneous as well as superficial, must be developed and made to contribute to our pleasures and to the necessities of the world. A very significant chapter, and one particularly pertinent to many of the preceding pages, might be written on a decline of agriculture in the slave states. But as the press of other subjects admonishes us to be concise upon this point, we shall present only a few of the more striking instances. In the first place, let us compare the crops of wheat and rye in Kentucky in 1850 with the corresponding crops in the same state in 1840, after which we will apply a similar rule of comparison to two or three other slaveholding states. The story of these figures is too intelligible to require words of explanation. We shall therefore drop this part of our subject and proceed to compile a couple of tables that will exhibit on a single page the wealth, revenue, and expenditure of the several states of the Confederacy. Let it be distinctly understood, however, that in the compilation of these tables, 3,204,313 Negroes are valued as personal property and credited to the southern states, as if there were so many horses and asses, or bridles and blankets, and that no monetary valuation whatever is placed on any creature of any age, color, sex, or condition that bears the upright form of man in the free states. What a towering monument to the beauty and glory of free labor! What irrefragable evidence of the unequaled efficacy and grandeur of free institutions! These figures are indeed too full of meaning to be passed by without comment. The two tables from which they are borrowed are at least a volume within themselves, and after all the pains we have taken to compile them, we shall perhaps feel somewhat disappointed if the reader fails to avail himself of the important information they impart. Human life in all ages has been made up of a series of adventures and experiments, and even at this stage of the world's existence, we are almost as destitute of a perfect rule of action, secular or religious, as were the erratic contemporaries of Noah. It is true, however, that we have made some progress in the right direction, as it seems to be the tendency of the world to correct itself. And we may suppose that future generations will be enabled by intuition to discriminate between the true and the false, the good and the bad, and that with the development of this faculty of the mind, error and discord will begin to wane, and finally cease to exist. Oh my, sometimes people are so naive. Of all the experiments that have been tried by the people in America, slavery has proved the most fatal, and the sooner it is abolished, the better it will be for us, for prosperity and for the world. One of the evils resulting from it, and that not the least, is apparent in the figures above. Indeed, the unprofitableness of slavery is a monstrous evil. When considered in all its bearings, it makes us poor. Poverty makes us ignorant. Ignorance makes us wretched. Wretchedness makes us wicked, and wickedness leads to the devil. Facts truly astounding are disclosed in the last two tables, and we could heartily wish that every intelligent American would commit them to memory. The total value of all the real and personal property of the free states, with an area of only 612,597 square miles, is 1,166,081,371 greater than the total of all the real and personal property, including the price of 3,204,313 Negroes of the slave states, which have an area of 851,508 square miles. But extraordinary as this difference is in favor of the North, it is much less than the true amount. On the authority of Southerners themselves, it is demonstrable beyond the possibility of refutation that the intrinsic value of all the property in the free states is more than three times greater than the intrinsic value of all the property in the slave states. James Madison, a Southern man, fourth president of the United States, a most correct thinker and one of the greatest statesmen the country has produced, quote, thought it wrong to admit the idea that there could be property in man, end quote. And we endorse to the full extent this opinion of the profound editor of the Federalist. We shall not recognize property in man. The slaves of the South are not worth a groat in any civilized community. No man of genuine decency and refinement would hold them as property on any terms. In the eyes of all enlightened nations and individuals, they are men, not merchandise. Southern pro-slavery politicians, some of whom have not hesitated to buy and sell their own sons and daughters, boast that the slaves of the South are worth $1,600 million. And we have seen the amount estimated as high as 2,000 million. Mr. DeBow, the Southern superintendent of the 7th Census, informed us the value of all the property in the slave states, real and personal, including slaves, was in 1850 only $2,936,090,737, while, according to the same authority, the value of all the real and personal property in the free states, genuine property, property that is everywhere recognized as property, was at the same time $4,102,172,108. Now all we have to do in order to ascertain the real value of all the property of the South, independent of Negroes, whose value, if valuable at all, is of a local and precarious character, is to subtract from the sum total of Mr. DeBow's return of the entire wealth of the slave states the estimated value of the slaves themselves, and then, by deducting the difference from the intrinsic value of all the property in the free states, we shall have the exact amount of the overplus of wealth in the glorious land of free soil, free labor, free speech, free presses, and free schools. And now to the task. The entire wealth of the slave states, including the slaves, the estimated value of the slaves, the true wealth of the slave states, the true wealth of the free states, the true wealth of the slave states, and what the balance in favor of the free states is $2,776,081,371. There, friends of the South and of the North, you have the conclusion of the whole matter. Liberty and slavery are before you. Choose what you will have. As for us, in the memorable language of the immortal Henry, we say, quote, give us liberty or give us death. In the great struggle for wealth that has been going on between the two rival systems of free and slave labor, balance above exhibits the net profits of the former. The struggle on the one side has been calm, laudable, and eminently successful. On the other, it has been attended by tumult, unutterable cruelties, and disgraceful failure. We have given the slave drivers every conceivable opportunity to vindicate their domestic policy, but for them to do so, it is a moral impossibility. Less than three quarters of a century ago, say in 1789, for that was about the average time of the abolition of slavery in the northern states, the South, with advantages in soil, climate, rivers, harbors, minerals, forest, and indeed almost every other natural resource, began an even race with the North in all the important pursuits of life. And now, in the brief space of scarce 70 years, we find her completely distanced, enervated, dejected, and dishonored. Slave drivers are the sole authors of her disgrace. As they have sown, so let them reap. As we have seen above, a careful and correct inventory of all the real and personal property in the two grand divisions of the country discloses the astounding fact that in 1880, in 1850, the free states were worth precisely $2,766,081,371, more than the slave states. $2,766 million. Think of it. What a vast and desirable sum. How much better off the South would be with it than without it. Such is the enormous amount out of which slavery has defrauded us during the space of 61 years, from 1789 to 1850, being an average of about $45,350,000 per annum. During the last 25 or 30 years, however, our annual losses have been far greater than they were formerly. There has been a gradual increase every year, and now the ratio of increase is almost incredible. No patriotic Southerner can become conversant with the facts without experiencing a feeling of alarm and indignation. Until the North abolished slavery, she had no advantage of us whatever. The South was more her equal in every respect. But no sooner had she got rid of that hampering and pernicious institution than she began to absorb our wealth. And now it is confidently believed that the merchants and Negro-driving pleasure seekers of the South annually pour $120 million into her coffers. Taking into account, then, the probable amount of money that has been drawn from the South and invested in the North within the last 6 years, and adding it to the grand balance above, the net profits of the North up to 1850, it may safely be assumed that in the present year of grace, 1857, the free states are worth at least $3,400 million more than the slave states. Let him who dares gainsay these remarks and calculations, no truthful tongue will deny them, no honorable pen can controvert them. One more word now as to the valuation of Negroes. Were our nature so degraded, our conscience so elastic, as to permit us to set a price upon men, as we would set a price upon cattle and corn, we should be content to abide by the appraisement of the slaves of the South, and would then enter into a calculation to ascertain the value of foreigners to the North. Not long since, it was declared in the South that, quote, one free laborer is equal to five slaves, end quote. And as there are 2,500,000 Europeans in the free states, all of whom are free laborers, we might bring Southern authority back to us in estimating their value at $6,200 million, a handsome sum to offset the account of $1,600 million, brought forward as the value of the Southern slaves. It is obvious, therefore, that if we were to dispose to follow the barbarian example of the traffickers in human flesh, we could prove the North vastly richer than the South in bone and sinew, to say nothing of mind and morals, which we shall receive our attention hereafter. The North has just as good a right to appraise the Irish immigrant as the South has to set a price on the African slave. But as it would be wrong to do either, we shall do neither. It is not our business to think of man as a merchantable commodity, and we will not even by implication admit, quote, the wild and guilty fantasy, end quote, that the condition of chattelhood might rightfully attach to sentient and immortal beings. In this connection, we would direct the special attention of the reader to the following eloquent passage exhibiting the philosophy of free and slave labor from the facile pen of the editor of North American and United States Gazette. Quote, "In the very nature of things, the free man must produce more than the slave. There is no conclusion of science more certain. Under a system which gives to a laboring man the fruit of his toil, there is every motive to render him diligent and assiduous. If he relies on being employed by others, his wages rise with his reputation for industry, skill, and faithfulness. And as owner of the soil, there is every assurance that he will do what he can to cultivate it to the best advantage and develop its latent wealth. Self-interest will call forth what powers of intellect and of invention he has to aid him in his work, and employ his physical strength to the greatest possible advantage. Free labor receives an immediate reward, which cheers and invigorates it. And above all, it has the chief spring of exertion, hope, whose bow always spans the heavens before it. It has an inviolate hearth, it has a home, but it looks forward to a still better condition, to brighter prospects in the future, to which its efforts all contribute. The children in such a household are chief inducements to the nerve arm of labor, that they may be properly cared for, fed, clothed, educated, accomplished, instructed in some useful and honorable calling, and provided for when they shall go out upon the world. All its sentiments, religious and otherwise, all its affectations for parents and kindred, all its tastes are so impelling and stimulating forces. It is disposed to read, to ornament its home, to travel, to enjoy social intercourse, and to attain these ends. It rises to higher exertions and a stricter economy of time. It explores every path of employment and is therefore in the highest degree productive. How different is it with slave labor? The slave toils for another and not for himself, whether he does little or much, whether his work is well or ill performed. He has a subsistence, nothing less, nothing more, and why should he toil beyond necessity? He cannot accumulate any property for the decline of his years, for to leave to his children when he has departed. Nay, he cannot toil to better the present condition of his children. They belong to another and not to him. He cannot supply his hut with comforts or embellish it with the adornments of taste. He does not read. He does not journey for pleasure. Inducements to exertion, he has none. That he may adapt himself to his conditions and enjoy the present hour, he deadens those aspirations that must always be baffled in his case, and sinks down into ease and sensuality. His mind is unlighted and untutored, dark with ignorance. Among those who value him most, he is proverbially indolent, thievish, and neglectful of his master's interests. It is common for even the advocates of slavery to declare that one freeman is worth half a dozen slaves. With every cord to exertion thus sundered, the mind benighted, the man nearly lost in the animal, it requires no deep philosophy to see why labor cannot be near as productive as it would be were these conditions reversed. Though ever so well directed by the superior skill and urged forward by the strong arm of the master, slave labor is necessarily a blight to the soil. Sterility follows in its steps, and not afar off. What a difference plain and heaven-wide between the outward and interior life of a slave and of a free community, resulting directly and palpably from this difference in its labor. The cottage home, amid trees and shrubbery, its apartments well adorned and furnished, books on its shelves, and the passing literature of the day scattered round, the few, perhaps, but well-tilled acres belonging to the man who tills them, the happy children with sunny prospects, the frequent school, the church arrayed with beauty, the thriving handsome village, flourishing cities, and prosperous marts of trade, the busy factories, railroads, traffic, travel, where free labor tills the ground, how beautiful it all is in contrast to the forlorn and dreary aspect of a country tilled by slaves. The villages of such a country are mainly groups of miserable huts. Its comparatively few churches are too often dilapidated and unsightly. The common schoolhouse, the poor man's college, is hardly known. showing how little interest is felt in the chief treasures of the state, the immortal minds of the multitude who are not born to wealth. The signs of premature old age are visibly impressed upon everything that meets the eye. The fields present a dread monotony. Everywhere you see lands that are worn out, barren and deserted, in consequence of slave tillage, left for far more fertile lands in newer regions, which are also in their turn to be smitten with sterility and forsaken. The free community may increase its population almost without limit. The capacity of slave countries to sustain a population is soon at an end, and then it diminishes. In all the elements of essential prosperity, in all that elevates man, how striking the contrast between the region that is tilled by slave and the region that is tilled by free labor.
Well, thank you for that reading there, Merchandise. That was good, very good, and a lot of very interesting points. Sort of puts it on the line. We got off wrong in the wrong foot, even at the beginning of the country, but the North went for white agriculture, small farms and so forth, and industry, and the South went for slave labor. In the process, they suppressed white workers in the South, kept them in ignorance, a large percentage of them, with no education. They wore out the land. They cut down all the trees to plant cotton. And that's the way it goes. We're going to do some more reading on that probably next week sometime. But I hope you're getting something out of it to show that this black plague has been upon us ever since the white capitalist, corporatist, predatory guys, the elite, have been doing it to us for a long time. And they're going to keep doing it to us until we've identified who the real criminals are. And that, we've got secondary criminals that we'd like to get rid of. But the main criminals are at the top. And for the most part, they're white. And they care nothing for you or your family or anything else. Otherwise, they wouldn't be starting wars or getting involved in wars all over the world to get you killed. So anyhow, I'll be back with you. Well, I'm not quite done yet, but we will continue this next week. Let's hear a few ideas on the infrastructure of the United States that we've taken $1 trillion a year away from the structure of the United States and wasted it in foreign wars. Let's see what rogue progressives got to say about that.
And it's impossible to talk about this derailment without talking about this infrastructure crisis that we've been dealing with now for how many years? And this is a part that drives me crazy. There are millions of people in this country who would be perfectly qualified, from engineers, designers, laborers, painters, construction people. I mean, just right down and up the list of people who would be put to work on a massive U.S. infrastructure rebuilding, which we desperately need. And the only thing holding it back, we have the money to do it, and that's A. B, this is money that the government, our tax dollars, is where the money would come from. And there's God knows how many ways to raise the money if they're talking about new money. Of course, all we would have to do is, over the next 10 years, take one-tenth of the war or weapons industry budget, which is now approaching $1 trillion a year. If we took one-tenth of it, which would be $100 billion a year for the next 10 years, there's the $1 trillion that the estimates are would take to repair and replace our falling apart infrastructure. Now, you and I both know that until we get leadership in Washington, in both the executive and the legislative branch, that's not going to happen. And it has to happen. My God! Congress is the Republicans is guaranteeing, are guaranteeing more dysfunction and more breakdowns in the system because maintenance costs are only going to rise. I mean, it's not going to get cheaper. What are these son of bitches waiting for? Now, the breakdowns can range from minor inconveniences like roads closed or something that is relatively minor irritant, like being 20 minutes late to work, to potential catastrophes like what happened Tuesday. Now, what happened Tuesday is the most recent in a series of train derailments on that Northeast corridor route. Metro North, according to Think Progress, Metro North, the commuter line, shares tracks with Amtrak and has suffered several serious derailments over the past 2 years. Besides posing serious dangers to riders, the derailments set off a ripple effect that paralyzes the entire system, which causes God knows what kind of headaches and setbacks for riders and businesses and everybody. And Congress can fix this. They could begin the process of fixing it tomorrow if these sons of bitches would just get to work. Legislate the money. We had WPA. We're not looking for WPA. This is not the 1930s. It's a new century. There's new technology. The technology that could have electronically slowed that train down is missing from the Northeast Corridor, the most traveled section of rail in the country. Why is it missing? Because Congress will not appropriate the money. They want Amtrak to go totally private. They want everything to go private. Jesus, God. And according to what I have here, Northeast Corridor trains carry, according to the
Well, we had a cutoff there, but that, you get the point. You get the point. Now, I remember way back when I was first married, my wife and I were going someplace. I don't remember where it was from. I think it was L.A. to someplace, and it was Amtrak. And Amtrak was pretty new at the time, and the train was late. And I'm standing there on the platform talking to a conductor. I said, "How come there's a problem?" He said, "Oh, this is the way they're doing it. They're trying the private companies that are in the railroad business. You see, they own the rail bed, the tracks, and all that. We just own the cars, the government." And he said, "They don't want Amtrak to succeed, and they're doing everything they can to destroy it." And that was started way back, just after Amtrak got started. So it's been no secret these private corporations that have been in the railroad business have been trying to drive Amtrak out of business for a long, long time. And so that's one of the problems. A lot of people don't know that. They think that the Amtrak, financed by the government, is they also own the tracks and bridges and all that kind of stuff. They don't. They only own the cars that ride on the tracks. Okay, that's about it for today. We'll be back on Moon's Day with a whole bunch of new stuff, I hope. And 14-5, and Memorial Day. This is ridiculous because people don't pay attention to it hardly at all. They just give lip service to it. They don't really care, most of the people. They might be able to buy a new car on sale or something like that. But remember, this started back with, I believe, World War I. Millions of guys died, and so many died from the United States that went over to fight in that horrible war of trench warfare and gas and everything else. So we had no real reason for the people of the United States being involved in that, but Wilson, just another war criminal, drug us into it. And we really should take this day, this weekend, really serious, because millions of white men died in horrible ways. They were gassed, they were bayoneted, they had potato masher explosives thrown at them, everything else. And then, of course, all the white Germans who died, and all the other people, all the white French and white English. It's a terrible situation, but I think it'd be good for you to observe it in a very respectful way, and not run around buying things at Walmart and looking at new cars. 14.5, and we'll see you later.
Declaration of War, November 25th, 1984. It is a dark and dismal time in the history of our race. An evil shadow has fallen across our once fair land. A certain vile, alien people have taken control of our country. When the day comes, we will not ask whether you swung to the right or whether you swung to the left. We will simply swing you by the neck. This is war.
The right-wing sect which declared war on the United States government in 1984 had many names. The Brüder Schweigen, German for Solid Brotherhood, the White American Bastion, and the Order. Former members revealed that a special order assassination squad plotted to kill the heads of three commercial television networks, former Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and television producer Norman Lear, among others. The unquestioned leader of the order was Bob Matthews, a well-liked lumberjack from upstate Washington. After more than a year of tracking Matthews, FBI agents surrounded him in an island hideout near Seattle. During the shootout on December 6, 1984, the house caught fire. When it was over, Matthews was dead. After the fire, FBI agents launched a nationwide manhunt for Matthews' followers.
In spite of Matthews' death and the arrests of his supporters, agitation persists for a militant, separate, Aryan nation. Order members say that the war has just begun.
Bob really one hell of a man. And imagine a man that would die for his beliefs. There's very few men like that today.
Bruce Carroll Pierce was the FBI's most wanted man until his arrest. He was also the order's second in command.
Just because Bob died or we've had some deaths in the past or had some setbacks, I don't believe by any means that the movement is over or that our goals will not be accomplished.
The order was a secret army striking out at a federal government that was vulnerable to armed attack.
The government's weak. The government is pathetically weak. This government is so weak right now that if 5,000 men of any race, of any consequence, any type of philosophical fundamentalism stood up for the federal government, that we have 5,000 men who would die right now, for what we believe in, someone can do nothing about it.
People are surprised at what's going on, and I think it's a situation you have to report. Guys like Matthews and others declared war on what they called the ZOG, the Zionist Occupational Government. When that happened, you saw the Fed begin to scramble.
It was the robbery of a Brinks truck in Ukiah, California in July 1984, when the order made off with $3.6 million that drew the FBI's full attention. At the same time, Secret Service agents caught several members trying to pass counterfeit bills. After his arrest, a friend became a government informant.
I believe that those men are prisoners of war. And I would support them as prisoners of war.
Tom Metzger is one of the most popular leaders on the ultra-right. While media attention was fixed on the trial of order members in Seattle, from his home and headquarters in Fallbrook, California, an hour's drive from San Diego, Metzger continued to recruit for his organization, War.
This is a time of rapid communication, and we must be on the cutting edge of technology like anyone else. We like it because it reaches into maybe every home in the United States where there's a computer. Every young person that is into computers, and there are millions across the United States, and they tend to be sharp kids with these computers in their bedroom, and they can log on and get all this information.
To attract others to his program, Metzger also set up 24-hour telephone hotlines in 8 cities, including Los Angeles, Sacramento, and San Francisco.
Why are the Jews and their supporters so afraid of free speech if they try to terrorize their critics into silence?
Metzger also has a television
dollars they could have